I traveled 3 or 4 months out of the year to various parts of Africa, and occasionally come home and sign the guest book in our house. And several years ago, my wife Barbara was here, and our 5 kids, two of whom are here, spent 3 years in Ethiopia. Somewhat abruptly ended, and kind of have had Africa in my blood and the dust of Africa between my toes, or however one would describe it, ever since. I do bathe now and then, but the feeling for Africa and its enchantment and beauty and mystery and intrigue and despair and all of those things lives on. Perhaps we should get this started officially so we get it on tape. Betty, wherever you are, let's start. The title of this session is Africa, a continent, Christianity in Africa, a continent of crisis and contrast. And what I wanted to do in this session is kind of make some broad, sweeping brushstrokes about Africa and some of its situations regarding the church and Christianity, as well as some of the political issues relating to the continent as well. And perhaps getting carried away with those letters, words starting with C, of Christianity and continent, crisis and contrast. Perhaps one could say that a simpler title would be the context. That what I would like to do, and then leave time, of course, for discussion, is to state some things about the context in which God's mission is carried out, and how God's people involve themselves in God's mission in this somewhat complicated continent. It probably helps somewhat to see this map with the names, and even since this map was produced, one country has changed its name, as somebody already has gotten the answer correct. Upper Volta in West Africa, north of Ghana, is now known as Burkina Faso. Part of the changing picture of Africa. For those of us who are somewhat older in late adolescence and beyond, we remember from geography books a map of Africa that looks a little bit more like this, which presents the colonial empires, the colonial situation of Africa in the early part of this century, before the movement of independent states of Black Africa. And some of these names probably look somewhat more familiar. In the scripture, one of the texts that most often has been used as an impetus for mission and global mission, world mission, foreign mission, overseas mission, however it's been stated, is that part of Matthew's gospel often called the Great Commission. I don't personally think that is the best text or the best scripture to look on as an impetus for our mission, but would like to just focus on a couple of words of that, where it said make disciples of all nations, and to focus for a few minutes on that phrase, all nations. When we say make Christians of teach people, make them my disciples in all nations, are we talking about these nations, or these nations, or perhaps this would be more appropriate when we think of the nations of Africa. The nation really has two meanings in an African context, and in many African languages, the words for the country and the nation, which we have usually used in English as the word tribe, have kind of gone through a phase in which tribe was not used because of its paternalistic overtones. It somewhat is coming back again where it's used more freely in Africa itself. But the tribe would be the nation, and then the country. But most of the countries that one sees here don't reflect in any sensible way the real nations of Africa. Almost all of these borders were designed in Berlin in 1884 with no Africans present, and very arbitrarily the borders were set up, often totally disregarding the ethnic background, the ethnic nations of the peoples of Africa. Ethnicity is extremely important to Africans. It becomes probably the center of their focus. The language, the culture, really makes a nation. And one says, go and make disciples of all nations. Would think of the social structures, the laws, the passage rights, the medicine, the health practices, all of those things that relate to the traditional ways within the nation, of which these represent some of them, by no means all of them. Anthropologists and linguists differ in their statement of how many there are. Some would say 800 distinct nations of Africa. Others would go up as high as 2,000, because there are more than 2,000 languages spoken in Africa. It often is a bit humorous when somebody asks me on my travels to Africa, when you go there, do you have to learn the language? as though one could learn the language of Africa. But 800 is a number that's often thought of as distinct and separate ethnic, linguistic nations of the continent. And then you slice all of those into other countries and try to maintain some kind of unification. And you can recognize the difficulty. You have both centrifugal and centripetal forces going on all the time in every African country. The force of trying to build a nation, to build a unity of the country. And then also the force within the tribe, within the language group, within the culture, for its own identity. And some of that identity being lost as urbanization takes place, and as meeting with Western technological culture takes place, and people trying to hang on in some senses to tradition and being caught in the pull of consumerism, which we have imported along with a lot of other good things, bad things, with the Christian gospel, and colonialism and all of that mix. Forces pulling in both directions in every African country. We wonder sometimes, people do, and say, well, why can't they just get along? All these civil wars. I think there's 9 going on right now in one stage or degree of heat. If one could take, for example, Europe, and somebody from the outside, totally unrelated, not knowing, would draw a border around Europe and say, all right, all now you Germans and Italians and Swiss and French and Spaniards and Portuguese and Dutch, and now you get along. And you elect a leader. Well, you can imagine that Europe would willingly form a United States of Europe, would somehow pull all of its different forms of ethnicity together and form one unity. Of course that wouldn't be true. And it's not true in Africa either. And it will take a lot longer than the 25 years for most countries of independence to achieve something of that kind. That's one of the basic contexts of the continent, of the people in which God's people try to carry out God's mission. In the midst of the clashes and the conflicts and the crises caused by that situation. Let me show one more which shows something that many people, I think, are find difficult to believe, that the landmass of Africa is as large as the United States, Europe, India, China, Argentina, and New Zealand thrown in. The one country of the Sudan, for example, one of the larger countries of Africa, is about the same size as all of the U.S. east of the Mississippi. And if we were to take Ethiopia, for example, you could put a point somewhere near Seattle and draw a radius and include Montana and all the way down to Central California as somewhat showing the size of that country. So we have this vast continent, which in many cases, in terms of understanding of people, is still the dark continent. Dark in the fact that people quickly tire of trying to understand, well, it's too complicated. Well, we can't understand it. Well, those names are too hard to pronounce. To me, I think there's a distinct bias in our education system, in our system of media, in which we hear very little about Africa other than those events that reach catastrophic proportions, a famine of political oppression in southern Africa, overthrowing of the Milton Obote in Uganda last week. There are certain things that reach the news, but on the basis of daily fare of understanding and of textbooks and of learning, those 53 nations really, really escape us. I think it's one of the tasks, perhaps, for the church in its larger setting to help to help our understanding of Africa. As the church, in the Christian church, moved to Africa, it also found that, of course, Christianity was already there. We cannot take credit for the bringing of the gospel to Africa. Christianity certainly has its roots in Egypt, as you well know. Christianity was flourishing in Ethiopia in the 300s, as the trade routes began to develop along the Indian Ocean, and with the traders and travelers went Christianity, along with later the Arabic traders. Went Islam. The modern so-called missionary movement also has brought Christianity in a wide variety of expressions. And we have, as you well know, some things to confess about that, as well as some things to be grateful and thankful that the gospel has found this rich soil. Many people talk about how the gospel or Christianity is both rooted and imported in the continent of Africa. It's rooted in the sense of these long-term places where Christianity has been deep within the soil, has become indigenous, it's become contextual to its own culture, it has arisen out of traditional beliefs, and become assimilated in that way. It is also important in the sense of coming with Western ideas and thought patterns and been brought to, hopefully, so that it also can take root. In 1900, in the world, 80% of Christians were white, according to David Barrett in the Encyclopedia of World Christianity. In 1980, approximately 50% of Christians of the world are white, 50% people of color. And by the year 2000, quite probably 60% of the Christians of the world will be people of color. That represents a dramatic change, the shifting center of Christianity to the so-called South, or the South, the Southern Hemisphere, the South versus North, industrial versus lesser developed, all of these categorizations. But I think it also represents the fact that in many ways it's not only the shifting center in terms of numbers and statistics of people, but perhaps, and we'll hope to see later through this week, some ways in which maybe that shifting center of theology, of the center of the church, of spirituality, can be seen as emanating from a continent like Africa, and we can get over our bias of thinking that that we are the teachers and they are the learners, we are the givers and they are the receivers, because increasingly the opposite will be true and needs to be a reality. Christians are in Africa are not all of one kind. There are some 8,000 separate Christian denominations in Africa. Talk about pluralistic North America. Most of that number, well over 7,000, are small groups of what are known as African independent churches. And that's what we'll be talking about this week in the session entitled The Modern Pentecost. But even among those that have come through missions and the mainline churches, there are many, many denominations within those 53 countries. Since I represent the Lutheran Church in this endeavor, well to mention that there are Lutheran churches in 20 African nations, or countries, numbering some over 4 million people. There are 4 Lutheran churches that have more than 500,000 members. In the thrusts that the imported or the mission outreach into Africa took, that we've been speaking about the growth of the church in kind of broad brush strokes of numbers and statistics. A second, in addition to the planting of the church, of the work of missions was all of those things related to health and clinics and hospitals and dispensaries in a Western technological medical sense, for many, many decades, where it existed at all, existed within Christian missions. And tremendous advancements have been made, not only in curative fashion, but in the emphases on community health, vaccination, nutrition education, water preparation, all of those things. And yet, despite all of that effort, and despite decades of so-called development, and I say so-called, 80% of the children of Africa have no access to clean water. And the leading killer of children continues to be diarrhea, which of course is caused by a variety of parasites and other things, most of which are preventable. A second major cause is measles, which is also very, very preventable, as we have seen. Health has been that second major emphasis and push, and in many countries, church hospitals and clinics still are the main source of technological medicine. Of course, the traditional medicine continues, and hopefully in a later session we can talk more about the relationships of traditional faith, including medicine, and Christianity. The third, in addition to church and medical work, is education. With the missions came schools. Almost all of the African leaders, up until very recent times, were educated in mission schools, even those that acted in a very brutal fashion in the way they ruled their nations. The mission schools have been very effective in many parts of Africa, and yet illiteracy remains very high. There are, I think, many things that can be said about the advancement of African countries in these 25 years since the wave of independence in the early 60s. In many ways, you can see advances in Africa that are far greater and happening more quickly than advances took place in Europe, for example, in a period of time of moving into similar kinds of stages of independence. In many, many African countries, more than 80% of the children are now enrolled in primary education. One would have to say on the other side of that, that in most of those countries, the opportunity to move from primary to secondary education is somewhere less than 3%. 3% of primary school leavers have a spot or an opportunity for secondary education. So getting a high school or a secondary education represents something quite different to high school graduation in this country. One would have to say in another brushstroke that Africa has been plagued with economic and political instability. When people wrote and talked about Africa in the early 60s, it was all in terms of the emerging nations, with a lot of hope, a lot of expectation. There was all of the movement for complete takeover of what had been foreign colonial institutions. Missions willingly, in most cases, gave up institutions to government, hospitals, schools. It was the era, on the other side of that, of missionary go home, of the appeal from some sides for a moratorium on foreign missionaries. And that era has gone, and that time has gone, and that mood has gone, and in many cases the shift is somewhat going back, hopefully not to another age of dependence, but in all of the new strategies and thinking of mission into a real sense of interdependence and a real movement of enabling in appropriate ways, and not in some of the inappropriate ways that so-called development has taken place. Now, instead of emerging nations, one can pick up in most magazines articles about the submerging economies or the submerging nations of Africa, in which most countries that were net food exporters, for example, are no longer. They have the capability of, but they are not, even in spite of famine and drought such as Ethiopia and through the Sahelian region and other regions. Since 1960, 70 leaders in 30 countries of Africa have fallen by assassination or coup. There have been 100 completed or attempted coups. Changes are on the horizon in a number of countries in which esteemed leaders are coming to the end of their terms, and retired African leaders are not well known. That's because there aren't many. They don't usually retire. And one such who may is Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, who has said he will step down now this fall in the elections. He may maintain chairmanship of the party, which really means he's stepping sideways rather than down. But changes will be continuing to occur as nations seek to find their own. Half of the countries of Africa right now are ruled by military governments. And you know that quickly as you visit some countries where airport security and roadblocks and detention places into cities and so on are quite prevalent. Along with this submerging situation, one would note that of the poorest 25 countries of the world, 18 of them are in Africa. And there are many reasons for that, some of which are totally outside of the Africans' own involvement. I get rather upset to read very arrogant things of why can't Africans be like us, and why can't they rule themselves? Or Rhodesia becomes Zimbabwe and they have internal strife, and people say, well, see, black people can't rule themselves. Without remembering, for example, that after our independence as a USA, we were still fighting a civil war 100 years later and trying to pull together as a nation. It's only been a few years since Zimbabwe was born. And what isn't told in our media, which I would often characterize less as media and more as propaganda in this country, Zimbabwe is exporting grain to South Africa. And we talk about the white South Africa able to rule itself, and it's all of this. We'll get into that another day too. But here is black Zimbabwe exporting grain into white South Africa. The reasons for the economic situation in many African countries, as I've said, are not always within the countries. The world economic order is stacked against poor countries. And in decline of any kind of product in the world, the first to suffer are the poor. The gap continues to grow between the rich and the poor. The militarization of Africa, in which we and the Soviet Union have a direct play, a direct part, our increase in military aid to Africa has increased by 300% since 1980. And at the same time, except for the recent outpouring of aid to Ethiopia, our food and development aid from this country has declined. At the same time that food and development aid has declined in the last 5 years, our military aid has increased by 300%. And that, of course, African governments want to buy or try to buy, and there's a complicity, but we are also part of that in this intense buildup of the militarization of the continent and playing out our east-west battles on the chessboard of Africa when those don't really make sense to them. And we play out our struggles with the Soviet Union. You can look at the wonderful switch that was made between Ethiopia and Somalia in 1977, when was incredible change, where Russia was in Somalia and the U.S. was an aide to Ethiopia, and within a year, Russia was the Soviet Union was in Ethiopia, and the U.S. was totally involved in Somalia. There was just a complete switch. We play out our politics and our ideologies upon the nations of Africa. We could get into more of those kind of issues as well. The church in all of this confusion continues to grow. I think that's one of the miracles. It's the imported, the mission church, mission Genesis churches survived their identity with colonialism. As colonialism died, the churches did not. They were rooted. They have grown within the soil and the soul of the people. Tremendous variety of Christianity in Africa. One can go to a large cathedral-type church north of Moshi in Tanzania, which looks like the church was lifted right out of Bavaria and put into East Africa. And here, liturgies translated from the German into Swahili and Chaga and sung, and brass quintets from, you'd think you were at an Umpa band in the Bavarian Oktoberfest. Or you can go to a church meeting under a tree, in which the word is read, the songs are sung, and the people in their own language. There's no building. They are gathered in worship. It's a recognition of the spiritual power that is greater than the spiritual powers of their lives. You can go into small mud church buildings all over the continent, in the villages and the back places, where laypersons and evangelists and pastors are leading people in worship. You can go on the main streets of some of the big cities and go by on a Sunday evening a church with a name like Church of Jesus Christ of the Divine Healer Incorporated, or Church of the Cherubim and Seraphim, the White Cross Society, the Zionist Church of Jesus, Church of the Lord Aladura in Zaire, the Kimbanguists, all of these churches, and you would see people dancing and white robes and waving handkerchiefs and the drumming, traditional drums as well as electrified guitars and the whole mishmash of the cross of cultures of people celebrating and in a remarkably festive way. You can go places where the church is meeting quietly in the evenings in houses because of persecution. You'll meet such in some parts of Namibia at the present time, because of bans of government in certain contexts, although in most cases the churches are free to worship on Sunday in that setting. You'll find them in Ethiopia, in places where there is government pressure. The variety of the expressions of Christianity in the continent are overwhelming. One could look at other characteristics of the church in the continent. It's hard to make generalized terms about such a vast part of our earth. But the church is extremely vital. It reaches the total lives of people. There are very few places where there is a kind of Sunday morning Christianity. The church is very much youth-dominated in many parts of Africa. It is a place for youth and the expressiveness of youth. The communal expressions of Christianity are much stronger than the individualism of Christianity of this continent. The theology is somewhat informed by of course by its culture and its traditions, and one of those that is very interesting is its cyclical understanding of time rather than linear, and so a sense of history or a movement of the kingdom and the coming of events in the far future play less a role in most traditional-based African Christians than in other parts of the world. The church and its gospel expresses in many ways a holistic ministry. Africans often ask us why we are so prone to divide people into body and soul and body and spirit and social gospel evangelism, development, proclamation, all of these kinds of things when the message and the word and the reality is holistic. We have something to learn. And one final characteristic just to throw out into this is that in most cases the church is characterized by a hopefulness, which to me is often very, very difficult to comprehend. When I go there and get over my guilt of what I have and what we have and what isn't there and how people survived, and I'll realize that most of that is within me, and the guilt that is, and then to come and find people who are so hospitable and so hopeful and so expressive and in many ways so joyful, it is rather sobering and a reason for celebration at the same time. Well, I've spoken quickly and said what I hope are a lot of things, and perhaps too generalized, but let's see where some time of discussion goes.
I'd just like to comment. One of the books that I read, we had a South African exchange student last year, and we wanted to understand a little bit more about the continent in general. And one book that I found very easy to read and really kind of helped me understand, you know, why the Africans have had so much trouble, you know, with chaos and confusion and that sort of thing, was The Africans by David Lamb. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And it was just fascinating reading to see how the tribal influence that you had mentioned was so important in actually pulling the country apart at times. And I really didn't understand how colonialism had affected them as much too, when the Portuguese and the French and the English and the Dutch all just pull out all of a sudden and leave these people as slaves, really, and yet they hadn't really learned and helped them establish themselves. And it was really a real eye-opener for me to understand why things are happening there. And I really think that's important to have that background before you can really understand where they're going to go from here.
Yeah, that. The book is called, as you've said, The Africans by David Lamb, who was a Los Angeles Times correspondent who lived in Nairobi. He covers so much of the continent and so many countries, you know that some of the things have to be overgeneralized, and they are, but it is excellent to give an idea, at least, of these complexities, as you mentioned. The church and missionaries don't come out very very well in it, in many cases, many chapters, but that's all right. It's good for us to read that side as well. The triumphalism that we've often gotten from mission stuff isn't helpful either. Other books that that might be helpful in understanding the African understanding of their religion and are most helpful are books by John Mbiti, M-B-I-T-I. And I didn't send in a book list early enough, perhaps, to get
things into the library here, or into the bookstore, but... Any other comments? I know that others of you have experience in Africa and questions, yes.
Well, I'm just really glad you're here so that we can ask you questions, because only last year I became aware of how much our media falsely influences how we understand Africa, because I was so glad when Amin was overthrown and I thought everything was all better. And then a classmate came to Notre Dame from Uganda, and he was telling us that the situation's a whole lot worse now, even, and still progressing, and that there's just so much terror in Uganda right now. And I had sort of thought it was all better. Yeah. So I hope that we can hear from you a lot of perspectives that we ought to be aware of, that maybe we aren't aware of because we get only one side from the media.
Mm-hmm. One thing that our media does and our government does is always present things in the good guys and the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And we look at it like an old cowboy movie, and the world isn't an old cowboy movie. And it's, you know, like you say, Amin was a horrible dictator. Milton Obote was overthrown last week, and because of the terror that he had continued to impose upon the people. The complexities of the country, of the continent, are so much more within themselves, and they don't relate to whether somebody is pro-American or pro-capitalist or pro-communist or pro-Marxist. And we think that's the whole issue. And I think that's one of the big places where we superimpose our stuff on what's happening. I mean, there's enough going on in that teeming continent without imposing what we think are the ideologies that should be the issues. And they aren't the primary issues. If you would really ask Africans who are understanding their situation, you know, they would put it in terms of North-South rather than East-West, and would see us and the Soviet Union as part of the same, you know, the same force. The outside powerful developed technological forces that are bearing down upon them, and the same part of the same world economic order that creates suffering first for the poor, and then later maybe some economic discomforts for those of us in the so-called developed world.
How do you tie that North and South thing with the troubles in Uganda, for example, or Ethiopia and so on? I don't understand that.
That you probably would not, in terms of the internal, in the Uganda situation, internal politics, but as they look at the outside world, they would not look at the good guys and the bad guys from the developed part of the world, but they would look at the fact that the world economic order does not give them a fair break, and then they would look at in the sense of it being South-North. And this would be educated people who understand the situation, not talking about the person in the village whose major concern is something to eat and a roof over the head, said that the politics are only for those who are well-fed, or the discussion of politics are only for the well-fed. But that's, they would see both their own internal situation, and then as they would look at the world situation, they would see it much more North-South. They would see, for example, that the banks, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, have a tremendous hold on the internal politics of their country. Every country is horribly in debt. And they can hardly have enough foreign exchange to pay part of the interest and part of the debt in order to get another loan to make some more advancements. And so this banking system is stacked so totally against them by this time. for example, a country that's dependent on one product like copper. And I think copper here in this place, and if, as the price of copper goes down worldwide, if they've developed an emerging national economy and dream on copper, you know, that wipes out the country. It doesn't just wipe out a sector or a part of it, but the national economy, and the debt then rises to astronomical proportions that they can never repay. And all of this money comes from somewhere else, from the north. And with the pressure for advances on the loan, also comes instructions as to what they must do internally. You must devalue your currency. You must make certain changes in your health and education structure. You must make certain changes in the distribution of products and food within a country. So there's tremendous pressure by organizations like the International Monetary Fund on the internal politics of a country. Ghana in West Africa has gone through a little bit of a resurgence, and those educated people there would say it's because the International Monetary Fund is now ruling the country and not Jerry Rawlings. And, you know, which is a bit perplexing, but it's again the North, where the money is, where the power is, and it's for them not so much a matter of whether one goes capitalistic or Marxist or whether it's left or right, but they see themselves as being further pushed down by the technological world. I don't know if that gets at it, but within it there's certainly the internal politics that are within each country as well.
Because of the fact that the media and I think the Reagan administration focus on communism both as the reason why Ethiopia is in such a dire straits and why we have to support the South African nationalist government, maybe it would be helpful for you to say a bit about the place of Marxism as an ideology or the Soviet Union in relation to some of these famine areas and South Africa to help us understand better what's happening over there.
I don't know if we can do that in a few minutes. In the session on Ethiopia, I will certainly talk about that and how Ethiopia became, last September 10th, the first African nation to be declared a communist state, and how that rise of a Marxist ideology came in that country. In many ways, Marxism, as David Lamb points out in Africans, is another foreign trick played upon the African people. Colonialism, capitalism, communism, they're all in the same package. They're foreign ideologies that don't fit the people. I mean, that's one broad kind of thing to be said. In many ways, particularly in the South African situation, we have successfully made and created the liberation movements, forced them to become Marxist, because no one else will give them any support. You know, the same thing is happening in other parts of the world. We support all the wrong people. The South African government to me is very, very similar to Nazism in Germany. And there's a book called, by that title, Apartheid and Nazism, something real similar to that. And we continue to support that government by this policy of so-called constructive engagement of Schultz and Crocker and Reagan and company, which is constructive only for the ruling power of South Africa, and constructive for their continuing to destabilize neighboring countries. that's what's being constructed by our policy. And certainly not the situation of black people, not the situation of African people, even South Africa or Namibia or Mozambique or Angola or Botswana, any of the neighboring countries. We've successfully pushed freedom fighters away from us or our way of thinking toward Marxists, because those organizations, with some exceptions, have been the ones that have offered assistance. People have said that Marxism, communism fits very well into the African communal or communitarian way of living. And the way it's usually expressed in Africa doesn't really bear that out. It's another, to back up what I said earlier, that it's an inappropriate kind of ideology as well as the others that have come from abroad. The movement to help people become empowered from within, which Marxism says, you know, up with the people and the workers of the world unite and all of this, and you see it everywhere in Ethiopia now. All of the commercial signs have been taken down. You don't even see Coca-Cola, and there's hardly any place in the world you don't see Coca-Cola signs. And the only signs that are around are political slogans, and they're in the Amharic alphabet, so most tourists that come there don't know what they say anyway, but they're all there, and they speak always of the people in the motherland. But the reality of Marxist organizations don't have, except in some cases in South Africa, the kind of popular or base support or rising against an oppressor that they do in Central and South America. I think South Africa would probably be the only place where that situation would exist, and it's also probably why you see very little liberation theology coming out of Africa, except as one would equate the writings of leaders in Southern Africa because of that kind of political situation. Most of the countries of Africa declare some kind of socialism, and Nyerere, for example, in the Arusha Declaration in Tanzania, declared African socialism, in which a socialistic system lives very successfully and well right alongside of the church. There is a religious instruction in all the government schools in Tanzania, which is a socialist country, and we get so uptight when anyone says anything about socialism that if that's the next step to atheistic communism. And I think we have to be clear our terms and not use, as so often is done in this country, that we give aid where people are our friends ideologically, and if they're declared socialists, then they are not our friends. But a government in Africa doesn't exist that has been more supportive of the church than in Tanzania, which has been a declared socialist country since 1968, and gets comparatively very little aid from the U.S., which probably is all right, but it's the terms get used and they become all of a sudden a red flag. If it's socialist, then it's Soviet Union, it's communism, and it's far more complicated than that.
This is a very broad question, but I think some of us would certainly like to have you touch on that. We have to go home today, so it's something that's very interesting to me to have you touch on. The matter of food in Africa. There's a lot of evangelisms that spend a lot of their time and effort in getting us to contribute food to Africa. We're concerned about, I'm concerned about getting your impression as to whether or not this food actually gets to the people. We've heard that a lot of it is spoiled, a lot of it is used as a political tool, a lot of it is used to trade for arms. Would you react to that, please?
Yeah, I'll do it briefly, and we've been given strict instructions to quit, so we have to quit. Right. But let me just say that in a brief sentence, there is some corruption. Certainly, there isn't any government. U.S. government spends $700 for an ashtray for an airplane. I guess we can't expect the Ethiopian government to be totally pure. There is some use of food for politics, no question. There is some difficulty in getting through port. Part of it is African bureaucracy, which is sometimes incredible. All those things do exist. I think there are a lot of people in this country that want to make sure that everybody in this country knows that a communist nation will fail. I think that does exist. I think there have been a lot of photojournalistic stories that have shown things which give a false impression about Ethiopia and the effort of relief. What I would like to say is that, by and large, the food aid is getting through. And it needs to continue. We need long-range development aid with seed and to replace plows and oxen and all of this to help people become self-reliant on their own land and their own farms again. The trucks go through both from the south, from the government side, and from the north through the liberation movements. And through Lutheran World Relief, we contribute to both sides, which was incredible. That a government like Ethiopia allows us to provide food aid through the freedom fighters, which are their enemies, and in order to reach the people. Yes, there is corruption. Yes, there are some problems. Basically, the food is getting through to the people.
Thank you.